The UFO Story, a public service information program through the courtesy of this radio station. This weekly program will present factual and authentic reports on unidentified flying objects the world over and will present editorials by men and women from various fields of high standing from around the globe. And now, the UFO Story, Bob Berry reporting. After revealing many authentic and official reports to the public via the UFO Story concerning one of the greatest mysteries of modern times, unidentified flying objects, it would be quite an amazing phenomenon this day and age to find there are still people who can say, UFOs? Ha, no such thing, and not have their fingers crossed when they say it. However, upon reporting factual and authentic reports of amazing incidents concerning the strange objects that flit about in our skies at fantastic speeds and going through all kinds of maneuvers and colorful displays, if there is anyone that still says, no such thing, then all I have to say is you can lead a horse to the water, but you can't make that horse drink. If this type of person does not drink the water, in the sense of the word, it is because he or she won't, regardless if an object landed right in their backyard. The number of highly trained, intelligent people that are publicly stating that the UFOs are conclusively real is growing by leaps and bounds. More important, however, than the UFOs is a factor which has surrounded them since they broke into the news across the world in June of 1947. And that same thing is now beginning to surround everything in our daily lives which it should not. And that factor is secrecy, a seven-letter word that spells anger and more determination to the serious-minded UFO investigative organizations across the nation, across the world, for that matter. Another very fine investigative group in the United States publishes a monthly magazine called Flying Saucers, the Magazine of Space Conquest. Its editor is Ray Palmer, who conducts an unending investigation into the UFO mystery. Their headquarters are located in Amherst, Wisconsin. Mr. Palmer reports on an incident in the February 1959 issue concerning secrecy, of which I go along with due to the fact that I have run into the same type of closed doors when checking on an authentic UFO report. Did you know that there was a secret satellite circling the Earth at an altitude of 22,000 miles? You say, no. But that's probably just talk, and he doesn't even know what he's speaking about. Friend, grab a hold. For if the scientists at Cape Canaveral, Florida, say it is there, believe me, it's there. When you yourself can go and view it simply by exercising a little amount of reasonable calculation, it is there. Ray Palmer states, the first time they saw it, they reasoned that if it were a satellite, it would come around again, and they reserved their judgment until they did. It appeared exactly where it should have, which can be easily calculated by anyone with a small amount of astronomical knowledge. Now, we'll get back to the mystery satellite in a few minutes, but let's continue on this secret angle a little longer. Not too long ago, I outlined a report concerning the disappearance of a jet, its pilot, and radar man when it was sent to investigate a UFO over the state of Michigan. Remember? Well, let's dig a little deeper now into the UFO story. The news that the Navy suspects UFOs are responsible for the disappearance of several of its jets off Florida makes the word secret stand out a little more. Why should it be kept a secret? If our jets are being disposed of in some way by something classified as an unidentified flying object, then I think it's time the American public should be informed of it. Mr. Palmer brings out a good point. He wonders if Congress, like the American people, is being kept equally ignorant of what certainly is an important matter. Now, it should be determined positively whether or not the Navy has justification for its suspicion, and then it can be done to prevent reoccurrences of what is certainly a tragedy. Now, Palmer goes on to state that, quote, it is more of a blow to saddened parents to be informed their sons are missing and presumed dead than to be informed that the cause may be the mysterious UFOs, unquote. Now, when we are told, even in a hearsay manner, that the Air Force is fearful of disclosing all it knows about the UFOs because of the great burden of explanation it would have to face from the public, we're a little more than just angered. It would seem to me that the Air Force would want to get out and look for an explanation of the mystery. As Palmer states it, and I agree with him, quote, not by hiding their heads in the sand. Now, we expect them to get out and look for an explanation and keep us posted day by day on the progress, or by heavens, we, the people, will put someone on the job that will look, unquote. Now, that is from a quotation in the February 1959 issue of the Flying Saucer magazine, of which Mr. Palmer edits. Well, I think it is quite a known fact through recent news releases published nationwide, not only that the UFOs, but with other phases of the government, that our government is shot through with classified secrecy on many things that really should not be classified as such and should be known to the public. Now, some of our own congressmen have made statements very similar to that. Unless, of course, it is something that would endanger the security of the United States, and that's something else. I'm sorry to repeat that today, even though it is still classified as the free press, many facts that have been released by serious-minded organizations investigating the UFO mystery have been tossed into the wastebasket. But yet, those same newspapers, those same radio stations, and those same TV stations and other news sources will report to the fullest extent anything released by the government, especially the Air Force, concerning their alleged investigations of the flying saucers. Why? Why won't the free press or the newspapers, the radio, the television, and other news sources hear out the other side of that story? Let's remember, there's always two sides to every story. Why must it be a one-sided affair? Only one side of that story. Well, thanks to such radio stations as this one right now that you're listening to, you're getting the true facts behind many authentic and official UFO reports you never knew of before. And I'm happy to report nearly half of the states in this country, representing a staggering amount of radio stations, are hearing the UFO story as it unfolds the truth never before heard. The present-day policy of secrecy may have started out as a necessary item during the war. Even ship sailings had to be kept secret, and nobody argued against the wisdom of all security regulations. But today, this seems to have developed into quite a hideous thing, which destroys all that we fought for through the years. Everything is becoming top secret, and behind it a galaxy of information that should be released to the public, which is not a security risk to this country. If the UFOs are really from other planets, how will the facts about the UFOs in our skies scare the kids who have been blasting off with Buck Rogers since way back in 1926, I ask you? Now, there isn't a boy in America today who doesn't accept the reasonable possibility that literally millions of other planets in the universe are inhabited by intelligent beings, and that it would be strange indeed if some of them had not already traveled through space in the general direction of the Earth. The average youngster today, seeing a strange object in the sky, kind of looks up and says to himself, could be a spaceship. And if it was, he wouldn't run and hide someplace. He'd run into the field and wait for its descent and the men from another world to step out. He might even pick up a stick and mutter to himself, just let him try anything. But he knows it is likely they will not. People intelligent enough to travel through space from planet to planet are apt to be quite civilized and hardly looking for a fight. If Russia utters a warlike threat, it's made known through all the news media of radio, television, and newspaper. But if some fantastic UFO sighting occurred somewhere in the United States worthy of plenty of news coverage, about the only locality that would know about it would be the vicinity in which it occurred. However, I am happy again to report that the UFO story is being read and is being heard by thousands across the country via newspaper, radio, and UFO publications. The radio department of the Aerial Phenomena Investigation Society in OLEAN was the first organization ever to offer such a program on a nationwide basis, on the radio, that is, and it's spreading, I'm glad to say. Since the secrecy angle of the UFOs has been pretty well covered for the time being, I'd like to venture next into an alleged report of a message over shortwave radio from a being of the planet Jupiter. Now, here's a real mystery that I feel, and I know that you'll go along with this, demands some type of an answer. Now, listen, if you're a ham radio operator and you recall this incident, I would like to hear from you as soon as possible. Recently, a news item was printed in the paper, evidently in the southeastern portion of the United States, and Ray Palmer, the editor of the Flying Saucer magazine at Amherst, Wisconsin, received a copy of that article, which was written by Virginia Cruikshank of the Gazette Farm Editor. Now, that's all the information that is available regarding that newspaper at this time. And the release is as follows, quote, "Never underestimate the power of the enemy" is a slogan long familiar to us. For a lot of people in rural and urban areas in southeastern states, that slogan had added up meaning after they heard a weird broadcast on shortwave radio on the night of August the 3rd. The incident almost resulted in a panic resembling the one started by Orson Welles and his men from Mars. Nothing has appeared in the newspapers about it except in one column in a Florida paper. An Air Force man from Dayton who was visiting a local family told me about it. Names and places are being withheld for security reasons. The affair has apparently been hushed by the Federal Communications Commission. On Sunday night, August the 3rd, ham radio operators from Florida to Kentucky heard the voice of a man on the 75-meter international band. He said he was Nikoma from the planet Jupiter. He was broadcasting from a spaceship 50,000 miles from the Earth. He warned Americans that they must stop the hydrogen and atom bomb test because they will eventually cause the entire solar system to blow up. It will become so hot. He spoke for 2.5 hours in English, German, Norwegian, and the musical gibberish he said was the language of his home planet. The Dayton man heard the broadcast, and he can testify that it was no amateur job. Some radio operators, as well as FCC officials, made tape recordings of the voice. At the end of the performance, Nikoma said it was getting too hot, and he would have to take his spaceship back to Jupiter. It was the most powerful signal ever picked up in that area of the country. There was plenty of time during the broadcast for hundreds to listen in as radio operators called in friends and neighbors and phoned long distance to relatives in other states. Unquote. Well, there it is. That's the report, as carried in the Gazette, a southeastern United States newspaper, and quite a startling item to say the least. In a check with the FCC, it was stated that an inquiry by Ray Palmer was the first concerning the alleged broadcast. They didn't seem to know anything about it. The FCC does not state that there was no such broadcast, but it does limit its origin in a foreign country, possibly a tropical country, and therefore not under its jurisdiction, and in fact impossible to trace. Due to the fact the broadcast consumed 2.5 hours, no doubt many ham radio operators, as they are referred to, heard it, with some no doubt making tape recordings. Now remember, it was stated it was the most powerful signal ever picked up in that area. It was not an amateur job. It's possible this is all a big hoax and nothing to it. However, if it did occur and somebody did make a tape recording of it, or portions of it, then we have a different light shining on that subject, that of truth. If any ham radio operator hearing this broadcast recalls that incident and tape recorded the alleged talk, I would appreciate it very much if he or she would get in touch with me immediately. Now, you can reach me by addressing your letter to APIS, A-P-I-S, that's Aerial Phenomena Investigation Society, Olean, New York. Thanks, and I'll be expecting to hear from you. You've only heard the beginning, folks. That's right, only the beginning. Next week, I'm going to give a detailed report concerning a group of airline pilots that evidently are tired of being pushed around and told by the Air Force officials that they've been seeing hallucinations or something else. This report will be very interesting, and these pilots are connected with some of the major airlines in the nation. Soon, you will hear an interview with Kenneth B. Keating and former Secretary of the Air Force Thomas A. Finletter. Anytime a UFO investigator reports on findings involving some pretty fantastic UFO reports, he goes out on a limb. But the limb gets stronger when the public, slowly but surely, begins to discover some of the many facts behind the mystery of the UFOs. Well, that wraps it up for this week. Remember now, if you have any questions concerning UFOs, send a letter to me, Bob Berry, in care of APIS, A-P-I-S, Olean, New York. And if we can answer your question, we'll be mighty happy to do it, believe me. The UFO Story is a public information program presented by the Aerial Phenomena Investigation Society of Olean, New York, through the cooperation of this radio station. The UFO Story will continue at the same time next week. Bob Berry reporting. 50 airline and what they call straight line pilots have banded together. All have seen unidentified flying objects, and they have instructions to report each sighting. But when they do, they're told that they've been having hallucinations, sworn to secrecy, or told they haven't seen anything at all. Now, maybe it was the stars through the broken clouds. Boy, I still haven't gotten over that one. And if the pilots persist, they are asked if they prefer silence or go into a mental institution for examination. All of the 50 pilots are flying out of Newark and have banded together. They have decided to back each other up and are intending to make the whole thing public. Now, this particular report was carried supposedly on a Canadian newscast on the evening of December the 24th, 1958. Now, the name of that radio station involved is not known at present, and efforts are being made through space, the organization I just mentioned to you in Florida, that's their SPACE, and the organization headed by Mr. Norbert, that is, and APAS, to obtain this necessary information in order that this report can be more closely checked. Now, here is an authentic report concerning two airline pilots. Now, this actually happened, and we have definite proof of this through the report, an incident in which they became involved. The co-pilot of a super constellation en route from New York City to Miami, Florida, via the overwater airlane, saw a long illuminated UFO at a position of approximately 200 miles north-northeast of Palm Beach, Florida. The time was 7:35 p.m., and the altitude of the super constellation was 18,000 feet. A cigar-shaped object, and this is a common description of many UFO reports, crossed the path of the airliner at an estimated distance of 5,000 feet in front of the plane. It was a brilliant yellow in color with clearly outlined squares which gave off a silver glow. The object was traveling from east to west at the time, and according to the pilot, was traveling faster than anything that we have in the air today. When passing in front of the airliner, it was on a level course, but rapidly climbed upward and proceeded to the west. The object was only in view a few seconds, and unfortunately for the co-pilot at the time, the pilot was turned around in his seat getting something from his briefcase. By the time the co-pilot got the pilot's attention back into the night sky, the object had already disappeared. As a result of the pilot not seeing the UFO, no service, that's C-I-R-V-U-S, no service report was filled out upon landing. The airplane commander is responsible for filing a report of this nature, but since he himself did not see the object, naturally no report was filed out for the Air Force report. The co-pilot was with the Air Force during World War II and flew as a liaison pilot, and also as a co-pilot on both B-17s and PBYs with the Air Rescue Service. Since that time, he has had 7,000 hours of flying time with the major airlines, and at the time of the sighting was a co-pilot on the largest commercial passenger carrying flying out of the Miami International Airport. Now, since it is an airline policy not to release these reports to the general public, but to file the service report to the Air Force, that his name or the airline of which he works for be withheld from this report. Now, it was impossible for this to have been a missile firing witnessed from Cape Canaveral for two reasons. Those two reasons are as follows. Number one, the object was traveling from east to west. The missiles traveled to the south-southeast over a narrow corridor. Any missituation from this course is automatically destroyed, the missile. It's destroyed in the air as more or less a safety measure. Number two, the object seen was in an area 200 miles north-northeast of Palm Beach, Florida, which would place it north of Cape Canaveral. And we'll throw in an extra reason for good measure. If a firing had been imminent at the Cape, the airlines would not have been taking the straight over water route from New York to Miami. The airline, partly over land and partly over water, and west of Cape Canaveral, would have been used. In addition to the sighting report, this same airline pilot reports the following account of a UFO encountered in the air in November of 1952. At the time, he was flying a C-46 between California and New York, and the time approximately 1 a.m. Between Prescott and Winslow, Arizona, at an altitude of 11,000 feet, the pilot saw what he first saw was a falling star. It appeared in the eastern sky, which was clear at the time. It kept getting closer, however, and increased in size and brilliance. Then, pow, the object continued coming toward the plane until it seemed that it was going to collide head-on. Both pilots saw the entire incident very clearly. He pulled up into a steep climbing turn to the right. In the middle of the turn, the object, which the two estimated to be 100 feet in diameter and glowing a brilliant yellow, passed directly under the plane. The pilot came out of the turn on a reverse heading and then watched the object continue westward until it climbed upward and disappeared among the stars. The glow lit up the entire passenger compartment of that plane, which at the time was in total darkness. Several crewmen who were in the passenger compartment saw the light at the same time. The same day, the pilot and his crew landed in St. Louis and New York, and both places verified the fact that an unidentified object was seen by observatories and was picked up on radar, speeding across the United States at better than 2,000 miles an hour. Now, the times and the locations given coincide with the sighting of those two pilots. The airline pilot was quizzed by Norbert Garrity, the head of the Saucer Phenomena and Celestial Enigma, that's space, with headquarters in Coral Gables, Florida, and the questions went as follows. Do you agree with the current policy of summer secrecy on the part of these, on those in charge of investigations of this phenomena for our government? The answer, no. Now we're quoting, no. I can't say that I do, because I think the people in this country are certainly capable of understanding this, if it is put to them in the right way. Just like my own position, I am told by my company and the government, actually, indirectly, to make reports of any sightings which we have. We are supposed to make a report on it, but that's about all the good it does, actually, because that's the last we or anybody else hears about it. There's a so-called sort of investigation, and then they seem to try to explain it away or something ordinary, or try to tell you that you are just seeing things. No, I do not agree with the present policy. Unquote. In closing this particular report, it's noteworthy of pointing out once again that the Air Force does not recognize the flying saucers as being something definitely unidentifiable. They say that there are no such things as flying saucers. Well, let's keep in mind, the United States government does not officially recognize the government of Red China. Therefore, by their own reasoning, Red China does not exist. Hence, even though multitudes of saucer reports continue to come in from all parts of the world every day, they just don't exist, because our government doesn't recognize them as such, flying saucers. A few weeks ago, I outlined a report, now known by the public in general, concerning a mystery satellite circling the Earth at an altitude of 22,000 miles. Let's dig into that one and show you what happened. The hush-hush on this report, here it is, and the complete detailed account, including a network of our jets keeping track of it. Here's the report, thanks to Ray Palmer and his very fine publication, Flying Saucers, the magazine of space conquest of Amherst, Wisconsin. Shortly after the third Sputnik was launched, the world in general watched to see what was going to be the next move by the Russians in their conquest of space. It was the opinion of experts that the Russians would try some sensational event concerning space and satellites. A close watch was maintained, but nothing happened. As time drifted, the American public was informed that we were keeping pace with the Russians. Fine, I'm in favor of that 100%. I'm sure you are too. During the summer of 1958, many UFO investigative groups and the public kept their eyes on the skies, watching for the rocket carrier of Russia's third satellite to go over at scheduled times during the night. One night, a group was keeping a watch for the rocket carrier and its familiar pulsating light as it reflected the light of the sun during its tumbling motion through space. However, they missed the sighting and decided to check the sky and attempt to see it and to find it. While doing so, and looking into the southwestern sky, a large number of jets were seen. Well, now, what gives here? The jets were plainly visible, each with a light. The roar of jets were very audible, and it seemed to be coming from everywhere. Two jets seemed to be on a collision course. The group watched intently. Suddenly, they realized that some type of pattern was being flown by these large group of jets. The big question is, what are 20 or more jets doing in one small locale, where never more than three have been observed at any one time before, facially, at night? The answer was evident. At almost the same time, when rising out of the southwest, came a brilliant white dot, brighter than the brightest star, even brighter than Venus when it is the evening star. The brilliance of it dimmed, faded to less than half its original brilliance, then it started to glow again. After viewing this, and viewing it for a period of 15 to 20 seconds, it was very evident that this was fluctuating at about twice the rate than the third Russian rocket carrier. This suggested one definite thing: another satellite was in orbit. It floated slowly across the sky, covering the distance from horizon to horizon in a period of about 4.5 minutes, shorter than the 7 minutes of Sputnik 2. In the meantime, the jets wove a fantastic pattern over the sky, moving in the same direction of the fluctuating spot of light in the heavens, until both the satellite and the jets disappeared in the northeast. Now, this object was traveling in the southwest to northeast course. Was this another Russian Sputnik? And if so, it would reappear the next night, slightly to the west of its present path across the sky. The group decided to have a look the next night and see if the mystery object would reappear. A watch was set up, getting underway at 9 p.m. the next night. The wait wasn't very long. 45 minutes ticked away, and it happened 5 minutes before that object appeared. The same fantastic number of jets appeared in the sky and began the same sort of a pattern flying as the previous night. Then the orbiting satellite appeared. No doubt about it, here was a new satellite the world did not know about. Was it ours, or was it the Russians? Well, the fact the group of jets appearing two consecutive nights in the same area and following the object till it was out of sight, the group answers this particular question. It was thought that the jets were getting radar fixes on the circling satellite. Opinion was given by officials of the Flying Saucer magazine at Amherst, Wisconsin, that similar jets and similar jet flights were occurring all along the pathway of the satellite from the Gulf of Mexico to Hudson's Bay. It seems as though that only need for such activities, such as the jets were displaying each night, would be the fact of Russians identify for the new satellite, that this was a Russian satellite. It was further thought that as soon as the facts were gathered, the American public would be informed of the entire matter. No such information was forthcoming, according to Mr. Palmer's publication. Now, if American in origin, why keep the triumph a secret? And if Russian, what did secret and secrecy on their part portend? Palmer started to receive letters from his readers concerning the mystery object. Other publications started receiving letters from their readers along the same line reporting the satellite. The reports came in from Oklahoma to New Jersey. The time of the observation mentioned by the readers coincides with the sighting of the Palmer group. Now, this new satellite was so easy to observe that it seemed to be just a matter of time before official announcement would be forthcoming. Then a release, dated November the 23rd, 1958, more than 4 months after the initial sighting, occurred on the back pages of Aviation Week magazine on the date November the 23rd. A more complete report appeared in the state of Wisconsin and the city of Milwaukee. The paper, the Milwaukee Sentinel. Now here's a portion of the report as it appeared in the Milwaukee paper, Washington, November the 23rd. The WS-117L Sentry, first U.S. reconnaissance satellite, is scheduled to be shot into orbit December the 15th from Vandenberg Air Force Base, California, Aviation Week said in an article Sunday. A follow-up shot may be tried about 2 weeks later. It will include a payload of from 400 to 450 pounds, including a telescopic camera. Later versions will include infrared and television-type cameras. Although this is the first IS attempt to view the Earth with a satellite camera, the Soviets already may have put up a similar satellite. The Air Force at Cape Canaveral, Florida, on September the 24th, 1958, picked up a three-hour long signal from a frequency used by the Soviets, but not by the United States, indicating a 22,000-mile high orbit, unquote. Now, there's the report as it stood. Well, need I say any more? There it is, neatly tucked away and hidden very nicely halfway through the article. The headline indicated the Air Force is planning to fire a reconnaissance satellite, but nothing about the mystery satellite that was picked up at Cape Canaveral, Florida. In the headline, that is. To a newsman, and being a news director of radio station WMNS here in Olean and correspondent for the Buffalo Evening News, the portion of the news release concerning the signal picked up at Cape Canaveral, Florida by the Air Force on a frequency used by the Russian with the object estimated to be 22,000 miles above the Earth would have far overshadowed the rest of that article. Well, there it is. We've got a lot of UFO activity coming up for you and some very interesting articles coming up next week. Boy, don't miss it. This is going to be real special. But that wraps it up for this week, friends. The UFO Story is a public information program presented by the Aerial Phenomena Investigation Society in Olean, New York, through the cooperation of this radio station. The UFO Story will continue at the same time next week. Bob Berry reporting. The UFO Story, a public service information program through the courtesy of this radio station. This weekly program will present factual and authentic reports on unidentified flying objects the world over, and will present editorials by men and women from various fields of high standing from around the globe. And now, the UFO Story, Bob Berry reporting. This week's UFO Story will no doubt be one of the most talked about sessions in a good many months to come. And I hope that you, as Americans, will get busy and voice your opinions and request to your congressman. What I am about to relay to you, as far as I can see and understand, is taking away a man's own privilege and his right to express to interested persons what he saw or what he experienced. This is not Russia. and nobody should be permitted or have the power to go around to tell a man to clam up or else stand the chance of losing his job. Well, that's about the bulk of it, and brace yourself as we go further behind the scenes of the UFO story, and friends, the plot thickens. First of all, let's quickly go back over the UFO report of Captain Peter Killian of the American Airlines reported to you recently on this program. Captain Killian of Syosset, Long Island, a pilot who has flown the passenger planes for 15 years, said that three mysterious objects that looked like shining saucers appeared to accompany his plane for a period of 45 minutes on Tuesday night, February the 24th, 1959, on its nonstop flight from Newark, New Jersey to Detroit. He also said that the crew of 35 passengers also witnessed the UFOs. Captain Killian said that he radioed two other American Airlines planes flying in the vicinity, and they reported seeing the mysterious objects also. Our next move is to let you hear Captain Killian tell of his own experience in his own words. Thanks to the fast thinking of Hugh McPherson, who conducts a very fine record show over radio station WCHS in Charleston, West Virginia, this interview was accomplished. Mr. McPherson has brought many UFO facts and reports to his listeners for several years on his nightly record show and is to be commended for his very fine work in this field. Here now is a tape-recorded telephone conversation between Hugh McPherson and Captain Peter Killian.
I was on a flight, of course, from Newark, New Jersey to Detroit, nonstop. And the flight was carrying me through Phillipsburg, Pennsylvania, through Bradford, Erie, directly across the lake of Lake Erie to Detroit. My flight was 8,500 feet, and I was flying by visual flight rules above an overcast. The overcast itself was roughly 5,000 feet, and above the clouds, it was ceiling and visibility were both unlimited, with very excellent visibility and no upper clouds at all. Roughly about 8:45, while I was having my dinner, like all good pilots do once in a while, I noticed out on my left window there were three lights out on my left side of the 9 o'clock position. These three lights maintained this relative position from 35 to 40 minutes. Their color was from a yellow to a light orange, and these three lights were in a horizontal position. And they represented, or they assumed the same look as the belt of the constellation Orion. Mm-hmm. The interval was maintained throughout the distance of these three. However, occasionally the third object, which was in the last one in the line, he occasionally dropped back somewhat and also gained altitude. But generally speaking, they maintained their same position. Occasionally, also, they heated up quite a bit and pulled ahead to almost directly, let's say, at 11:30 o'clock to my position. And then they would slow down again and drop back right off my wingtip. And as I say, this went on for 35 to 40 minutes. It shook me up slightly when I first noticed them, but after looking at them for a while, I sort of got used to the idea. But anyhow, the one big thing that struck me very noticeably was the brilliance or luminosity of their color. It would go from a very light dim to a very bright, brilliant color. And then it would go back to dim again. And during this period, occasionally the light would be extinguished completely, and I'd only see two of them, and then maybe it would come back again, and there'd be three, and maybe the two lights would go out, and there'd only be one, and occasionally the whole three would go out, and I wouldn't see any.
Well, could you tell the distance from your plane to these objects?
No, I couldn't. It's impossible because I didn't either know their size or their altitude. They were definitely higher than I was, But it would be, well, the same thing would be if a person had a light in the middle of a dark field at night. It would be impossible for you to know, just looking at the light, if this light were 100 feet away from you or 1,000 feet. Because if you don't know the size, it gives you an idea of distance.
Well, Captain, you've been flying for 15 years. You've ever seen anything like this before?
No, sir. In all of my period of flying, I have never in my life seen anything even remotely resembling this. Of 15 years with the airlines and also about 13 years other than that commercially. A total of about 28 years.
How many passengers did you have on the flight?
I had 40 passengers, and after I first noticed the object, I brought it to the attention of my co-pilot and also my flight engineer. And we three sat there. The stewardesses came up, the two stewardesses, and the five of us actually sat there and watched them for quite a while. And in the meantime, I was mulling over in the back of my mind whether I should tell it to the passengers, but I finally decided to. And before I did, I also told them I only had a cup of hot tea to drink and nothing else, and that there were no lightning bugs in the And everybody took it very well. As a matter of fact, it was most enjoyable to them. There was only one passenger who was slightly apprehensive.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, there were several passengers who wanted me to go over closer, but I thought discretion was the better part of valor, and I remained on course.
Absolutely. Well, Captain, have you had any feelings in regards to unidentified flying objects before this?
Well, of course, I suppose I'm no different than all the rest of the average American individuals that we read about it, and we wonder if the person who had sighted it was, let's say, was sober or sane or telling the truth or what. And generally, though, you've all had a feeling like you couldn't discount them entirely. And that was generally my feeling. I thought, well, there must be something to it, but what, I wasn't sure.
Yes. Well, do you think that these could be possibly belong to our Air Force? Things that you saw?
In an airplane, I might like to say, in an airplane, only has several white lights. One is a landing light, which shines straight forward. And the other is a white tail light, which you can only see when you're to the rear. So in either case, if it were either the landing light or the tail light, it would mean that if it were an aircraft, would be either flying directly towards me or away from me. And in no event could they stay there for surely for 35 or 40 minutes.
Yes.
That in itself would refute the idea of it being an aircraft.
Yes. Well, another thing, Captain, did you notify any other planes in the vicinity?
Yes, I did. When I was over Erie, Pennsylvania, I called on my company frequency and asked if any other airplanes in the vicinity, and there were two. There was one around Toledo and another one around, around Windsor, Canada. And both of them, when I brought it to their attention, both of them sighted the same three bright, shining objects, and the other two also admitted that they were higher than they were. I then called Airway Traffic Control and asked them if they had a flight of any three planes on an airway traffic clearance, and there was none. I also tried to pick them up on my radar set, but our radar is primarily for weather surveillance and not for airplanes.
And could not pick them up.
So I didn't get anything on my radar.
Well, Captain, have you been contacted by the United States government or anyone in regards to the sightings or not?
Not personally. However, indirectly, I believe that we have a procedure with the airline that when there are unknown sightings of any kind, that we make a report to our company, which in turn reports it to the government for immediate dissemination, which I did at that time. I immediately called my company in Detroit, and Detroit itself gave it to the government for any unidentified objects of either on the ground or in the sea or in the air.
Captain, again, how fast were you traveling?
Roughly 280 to 300 miles an hour.
I see. Well, I do appreciate devoting your time to our listeners this morning, Captain. And if you're ever in Charleston, West Virginia, do you fly to this part of the country?
Yes, I occasionally do land there. I've been to Charleston many times, and I've always admired your city very, very much.
Well, what do you think about this Kanawha Airport coming on top of the mountain?
Well, you have a fine little airport there. It doesn't really accommodate all of the, let's say it's going to accommodate the larger jet aircraft, but you do have an excellent airport for the smaller airplanes.
Well, thank you, Captain, and when you're here in Charleston, please give me a ring and have a bite to eat with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Captain.
Not at all, sir.
Well, there it is, and our thanks to Hugh McPherson of radio station WCHS in Charleston, West Virginia, for this very fine interview. First of all, the U.S. Air Force commented shortly after the sighting that probably what the airline pilots saw, as well as Air Force pilots on the same night, were stars through broken clouds. I wrote to the Air Force Technical Intelligence Center at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Ohio, for an explanation of the sighting. The original news release stated that, quote, experts at ATIC figured the pilots probably saw stars through broken clouds, unquote. My letter was referred to the Department of the Air Force at Washington, D.C. I received a letter from the Office of the Secretary there, dated March the 18th, 1959. It states as follows, quote, your letter of 28th February, 1959, concerning several February unidentified flying object sightings, addressed to Air Technical Intelligence Center, has been referred to this office for reply. The American Airlines sightings of 24th February near Bradford, Pennsylvania, turned out to be B-47-type aircraft accomplishing night refueling from KC-97 tankers. The American Airlines pilot's report of the sighting confirmed this, and Air Force records show that the three B-47-type aircraft were in the vicinity of Bradford, Pennsylvania, on a night refueling operation. The tanker has several groups of lights, which at a distance would appear to be one or more lights. The time duration of a refueling operation varies, can well last over an hour, depending on the type of operation. The KC-97 refueling a B-47 will fly at an altitude of approximately 17,000 feet at around 230 knots true. This would account for the lights being approximately 30 degrees above the American Airlines pilot's horizon and his seeing them for 40 minutes, unquote. More on the Air Force later concerning this sighting later, but let's stay on this Captain Killian bit just a little longer. Captain Killian was given permission by the Detroit, Michigan headquarters office of American Airlines to release his report concerning his sightings. Remember during his interview, you had heard just a few moments ago, he states that he checked with the flight pattern office and they state that there was no flight pattern filed for that particular area at that time. As a result of this particular news release, radio stations, newspapers, and TV stations the nation over reported the incident. Killian received many long-distance phone calls, telegrams, and letters from all over asking about his sighting. He accepted a few speaking engagements near his home state to tell of his experience. Sightings continue to be seen the country over in days and nights to follow the now-famous Tuesday, February the 24th sighting of Captain Killian. Then, something happened. He was told to cease telling of his experience concerning his sighting of three flying saucers. Thursday, April the 2nd, 1959, the Aerial Phenomena Investigation Society in Olean, New York, received reports from three serious-minded UFO investigative groups, all reporting the same thing. Captain Killian has hushed up. He won't talk. More on this next week. Well, that wraps it up for this week. If you have any questions concerning unidentified flying objects, send a letter to me, Bob Berry, in care of APIS, A-P-I-S, 328 North 6th Street, Olean, O-L-E-A-N, Olean, New York, and we'll do our best to answer your questions. The UFO Story is a public information program presented by the Aerial Phenomena Investigation Society of Olean, New York, through the cooperation of this radio station. The UFO Story will continue at the same time next week. The Aerial Phenomena Investigation Society, with headquarters in Olean, New York, presents the UFO Story, a public service information program through the courtesy of this radio station. This weekly program will present factual and authentic reports on unidentified flying objects the world over, and will present editorials by men and women from various fields of high standing from around the globe. And now, the UFO Story, Bob Berry reporting. Now, let's get down to some pretty serious accounts concerning Captain Peter Killian and the big hush-hush regarding his UFO sighting on Tuesday night, February the 24th of 1959. the Aerial Phenomena Investigation Society received official reports from three serious-minded UFO investigative groups on Thursday, April the 2nd, 1959. First of all, a report from a member of the New York Saucer Information Bureau with headquarters in New York City. This report comes from Miss Mariana Best of Brooklyn, New York. It states, quote, "Suppose you have heard of the silencing of our American Airlines pilot, Captain Killian. I heard him speak and tell his story at a meeting of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena affiliate here in Brooklyn, March the 12th. Then he was to appear on the Kehoe program last Friday." Now, at this point, she is referring to Major Donald E. Kehoe, U.S. Marine Corps, retired, and the director of NICAP, Washington, D.C., and at a New York Saucer Information Bureau membership meeting on Saturday the 28th of March. Instead, the Air Force visited him to serve notice. He was told not to talk. Captain Killian canceled his dinner engagement with Major Kehoe. His wife, almost in tears, did the telephoning cancellation of the engagement. Killian was too upset to talk. If he had continued, it would have been at a price of losing his job with American Airlines. Major Kehoe promised that a congressman from Baltimore is going to raise a stinko in Congress and that Captain Killian will have his day in court. We'll see. He also reports a great deal of interest in Captain on Capitol Hill in an investigation into the secrecy policy. Unquote. She also reported the same outline for the organization Understanding, Unit Number 14 of Brooklyn, New York, of which she also is a member. The third report of this incident on Captain Killian's hush-up came from Douglas Smapes, the director of the New York Division Headquarters in Buffalo, New York, of the Intercontinental Aerial Research Foundation, another very serious-minded UFO investigative group. It states, quote, "Captain Peter Killian has been requested not to relate his story further. I think others have been approached also. Major Kehoe ruffled. More later, signed Douglas Smapes," unquote. Well, there it is, in a nutshell. The man has been told to shut up or stand a chance of losing his job. What's behind all this taboo anyway? First of all, Captain Killian was given permission by American Airlines at Detroit to release his report to the reports of reporters of radio, newspaper, and television. A matter of a few weeks zooms by, and now, according to these three reports from UFO groups, the Air Force has told him to quit and to be quiet. It's not quite clear as yet whether he was approached direct by the Air Force or whether the order came from company headquarters. As soon as the complete information is available, we'll get it to you immediately. But regardless, I think it's time that the people of this country get busy, sit down and write their congressman a letter and demand a complete, thorough, and honest investigation into the unidentified flying objects. Let the congressman hear the reports from other sources other than the Air Force. You know, there's two sides to this UFO mystery. The Air Force and the thousands upon thousands that have seen these UFOs. Let the Air Force try to tell some of those that they've been seeing things or didn't know what they were looking at the time and that it was a known object misidentified. Incidentally, I would like to add at this time that the New York Daily News carried a report on February the 26th of 1959 concerning another UFO sighting. I quote, "Copenhagen, February the 25th, special. Two Scandinavian airline pilots reported independently today that they had seen square flying saucers last night over Denmark," unquote. Man, dig that crazy report. Now, what's unusual about this is that their sighting, reported independently, remember, occurred on the very same night as that of Captain Peter Killian and the other two pilots of American Airlines, plus the sightings made by Air Force pilots. Come on, you guys. Let's get off of that high stool of secrecy and let us in on the facts. It's the facts we want, not a bunch of running around and trying to avoid the issues. Let's have the facts. I wonder if the Scandinavian pilots have been told to clam up. Staying on the Captain Killian story for a little while longer, let's look at the general routine of happenings that occur after a series of UFO sightings that involve a lot of people the country over. First of all, we have all the sightings of the month of February, 1959. Now, these sightings were made by competent pilots of commercial airlines, as well as competent pilots of the U.S. Air Force, plus persons from all walks of life. Now, what does the Air Force have to say about all of these February sightings? Well, it's their usual pattern. And you'll bear me out on this if you've been a constant follower of UFO reports and analysis. It's to debunk the whole thing is a bunch of nothing and make those reporting the sightings look like a bunch of stupid people, which in turn would have future effects on persons sighting UFOs and will actually, they would have a hesitation making a report for fear of being ridiculed. rather a poor system, I think, and so do many others. Let's look at a report from the February-March 1959 issue of the UFO Investigator. Now, this is distributed by the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena with Major Donald E. Kehoe, U.S. Marine Corps retired as its director with headquarters in Washington, D.C. The headline in this particular bulletin states, quote, Air Force spokesman ridicules UFO witnesses, say some are drunks. Action follows airline pilots' reports of UFO formation in an attempt to discredit six airliner crews who reported the UFO formation. An Air Force headquarters spokesman has publicly ridiculed all flying saucer witnesses. Some were sarcastically labeled as persons who, quote, can't remember anything when they sober up the next day, unquote. The rest, implied the official spokesman, either were deluded by ordinary objects or were outright liars. This official Air Force statement was in direct answer to an inquiry by the New York Herald Tribune about the sighting of the UFO formation by six American and United Airlines crews on February the 24th, 1959. The Air Force answer appeared in the March 1st edition of the newspaper. Well, first of all, since rigid airline rules prohibit pre-flight drinking, as the Air Force well knows, this was obviously a deliberate slur. Apparently, the Air Force spokesman hoped, by grouping the pilots as drunks, to offset the testimony of these capable observers. At best, the Air Force statement branded the crews, 12 pilots and several flight engineers, as incompetent or deluded. Let's check out the United Airlines pilots' report. Three crews of United Airlines also spotted the mystery objects reported by Captain Killian on Tuesday, February the 24th of 1959. In one case, Captain A.D. Yates reported the objects were tracked from 8:40 to 9:10 p.m. between Lock Haven, Pennsylvania and Youngstown, Ohio. This was confirmed by flight engineer L.E. Bainey. The UFOs were also seen by the crews of United Flights number 937 and 321, both flying west from Newark. While observing the objects, the crews had discussed them by radio. All the pilots and flight engineers agreed that the lights were on separate vehicles, which were holding a formation. At Akron, Ohio, added confirmation came from ground witnesses. Between 9:15 and 9:20 p.m., several UFO reports were logged on the Akron UFO Research Group. All the witnesses described three glowing objects. In Detroit, Lieutenant Colonel Lee B. James, an Army missile expert associated with Wernher von Braun in the Army Ordnance Missile Command at Huntsville, said that the objects seen in the air by the airline's crews were quite possibly from outer space. Quoting him now, he says, I know they are not from here, said the missile expert, and they are not coming from Russia. We in this civilization are not that advanced yet, unquote. Colonel James went on to say that if the crews and passengers really saw what they reported, the objects, quote, would have to come from outer space, a civilization decades ahead of ours, unquote. Well, this is part one of the recent UFO sightings and Air Force reaction. Let's take a look at part two and a complete turnabout by the Air Force by denying they knew of a certain sighting of a TV engineer for WCHS-TV in Charleston, West Virginia. This one is a Lulu, and someone certainly owes an explanation somewhere. Thanks to the Daily Mail of Charleston, West Virginia, and Hugh McPherson of radio station WCHS Charleston for the following report. Now listen closely to the facts. Then listen to the reply sent to me by the Air Force in Washington, and you draw your own conclusions. Quote, At 4:20 a.m. on February the 7th, 1959, a strange object descended from above and hovered for a few seconds over a car driving along a lonely stretch of U.S. Route 601 somewhere in South Carolina. The driver of the car was Emmett West, 1216 Baines Street, an engineer at WCHS-TV in Charleston. He related his experience as follows. I was driving along and noticed the hood of my car was reflecting a greenish-colored light. Looking up, I saw a large round object descending directly on the car. It appeared to be about 100 feet in diameter. It stopped at about 5,000 feet above me and hovered there for nearly a minute, West stated. He said the object then began to drift horizontally to the left. I got a wonderful view of it then, he said. It was flat on the bottom and had a curved top. There was a sort of luminescent band of greenish light surrounding it, but the center was white. West stopped the car and started to back up to observe the strange object longer. As soon as I started backing up, it left, West stated. It moved horizontally and was out of sight over the horizon in a matter of seconds. I've never seen anything move so fast. West, who is a ham radio operator and carries a radio transmitter in his car, attempted to contact other ham stations in the area to confirm his experience. None could be reached. Upon reaching Bluefield, West Virginia, West contacted the Civil Air Patrol to see if they had any reports. They didn't. Arriving in Charleston several hours later, he discovered that the Air Force had called for him and wanted him to contact them immediately. He got in touch with the officials at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Dayton, Ohio. They talked to him for some time. Now, I was informed that the long-distance telephone conversation lasted for a period of 55 minutes. Now, they wanted to know exactly what had happened regarding his sighting. In all, they asked me the same thing three times, West said. I guess they were trying to see if my story varied, but it didn't. West had some questions for the Air Force, too. Quote, was my experience unusual, he asked. Not at all, was the reply. Well, did anyone else report the same thing I did? It's possible, was the answer. Air Force officials would divulge no further information. West is not a person to get excited easily. He has flown for 20 years and is not known among his friends as a person who believes unexplained things readily. I'd heard of unidentified flying objects for years, he stated. Although I didn't deny their existence, I wanted to see for myself. I considered them possible, but not probable. But now, I'm firmly convinced that there's something to all of these stories that you hear, West stated. What I saw that night had to be controlled, and common sense will tell you whatever it was could not have been anything we know, he said. It couldn't have been a flare. They don't hover in midair or travel horizontally. I would also rule out balloons. They couldn't possibly attain the speed this object did. West continued by saying, quote, I certainly don't believe it could have been anything put into the air by the United States or any other country. His ambition now was to see the inside of one of those objects. Next, let's recheck the letter I sent to the Air Force regarding West's sighting and the results of the Air Force reply. That will be the activity of the UFO story in just a moment. Getting along now with the Emmett West sighting I was discussing recently. First of all, I'll read the section of my letter to the Air Technical Intelligence Center at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Dayton, Ohio, dated February the 28th of 1959. Quote, the chief engineer of television station WCHS-TV, Charleston, West Virginia, was returning from the state of Florida during the week of February the 15th, and while in the state of North Carolina around 4 a.m., a bright UFO came into the area and hovered directly over his car, lighting up the area around his automobile, unquote. Now for the reply of the Air Force regarding West's sighting and his conversation with officials at ATIC in Dayton. The Air Force letter from Washington, D.C., dated March the 18th, 1959, states as follows, quote, the Charleston, West Virginia sighting during the week of February the 15th has not been reported to the U.S. Air Force. The statement that ATIC officials interviewed anyone concerning this sighting is absolutely false, unquote. Well, now what have we here? The only thing offhand that I can think of is the fact that in my letter I stated the wrong date. The sighting occurred on the 7th of February, and I was under the impression that it was the 15th. That would have given the Air Force the proper grounds to disown the report since it did not occur on February the 15th. Now, regardless, I am quite sure that there are enough details that they would know of whom I was referring to and could have given me the requested information regarding the conversation between ATIC officials and Mr. West, providing it did take place. There is definitely something in the wind here, and we're going to dig into this matter a little deeper. Now, to get to the correct facts, the dates, and all of the necessary information, and to do this, another letter had to be sent to the Air Force with the correct information. I'll relay the letter to you next week. Well, that wraps it up for this week. The time's gone once again, and if you have any questions concerning unidentified flying objects, send a letter to me, Bob Berry, in care of APHIS.